smell is everywhere I go. It's my thinking. It's that thing that lives between my ears. But this is what's cool about it, you know. Earl don't have hands. And Earl don't have legs. And Earl don't have arms or elbows. So Earl, no matter what he says between my ears, cannot go get his own self a hit of crack. He cannot go get his own self a beer. You know what I mean? He's got to convince me, the clean and sober me. I woke up this morning loving who I am, me, to go get him a drink of liquor.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
Welcome to the Most High Show, made by and for people in recovery, a show about recovery, spirituality, and being human. Our mission is to provide impactful, community-driven media that informs, empowers, and inspires positive change. Real people, real stories, real life. This is the Most High Show. All right. Second time's a charm? Third time's? I don't know how many times. We have been having technical difficulties, guys, but we are here, and we're still going to do the thing. And joining us tonight is Ricky, who is a saint and has been super patient while we get our shit together. Y'all, it's been, you know what? Shout out to all the people doing
And we're still sober.
We're still sober. Yeah. If anyone here relapses over this, we got you guys.
Follow me home.
Please don't follow me home. I live with a probation officer. anyway, but yeah, joining us tonight is a longtime friend of the show. We have Ricky here. And it's been a couple years since you've been around the Most High Show. So welcome back. Welcome to this spot. It feels silly saying the same words again, but.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here in the new office. And Josie have done such a great job on the decor. I'm just in contrast with Christian's art.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, thank you, yes, very much. Yes. I put my foot in it. We wanted to showcase Christian's personality and Christian's essence all over the walls.
Awesome. Just awesome. It's in the air, man. I'm telling you. It's in the air.
Yeah, it is in the air. And on the walls.
Okay, so, wow. So, also here in physical form and not just the essence, Ricky's going to share a story with us.
How did you meet the essence of Christian and the life form of Christian?
I was at an event over in Tucker, and I met Troy Abrams. And at that time, Troy had a podcast called Clean Dreams. Mm. And I met him through the event and ended up on his podcast. And he introduced me to Christian. So that's how the whole Most High Media, I got involved.
Mm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what, were you on the show to start with? Or were you just hanging around? Like, what was it like back then?
It was pretty cool. Well, it wasn't Christian's show. It was Troy's show, Clean Dreams.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Troy knew Christian because I think they shared equipment. They were all growing up together at that time. Mm. So it was when everything was a lot smaller. Mm. So, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, and I couldn't even tell you what year it was, but. It was deep back there. It was deep. What? If I try and think about the year, but it's been a minute. God, probably almost 8, 9 years, maybe. Oh, wow. Something like that. So it's been a minute.
Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for our newer listeners, how long have you been in recovery yourself?
I got sober April 15th, 1990.
Yeah.
I just celebrated 35 consecutive years.
That's amazing.
Yeah. One day at a time.
Hell yeah.
Yep. Newcomers, relapse do not have to be a part of your program.
Mm-hmm. So is it, are you one chip wonder?
Yes.
That's awesome.
Oh. One white chip.
That's incredible.
Yep.
And how was it, you know, getting sober in the early 90s as opposed to like seeing people trying to get it today?
It was tough, you know. When I first came into the program, it was the early 90s. And to be honest, people were dying. AIDS was rampant during mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm. So people were getting clean and the disease was rampant. So that was a pivotal point, you know. But it was pretty cool. I didn't want it when I got it. So I was kind of bamboozled into recovery.
Bamboozled?
Yes.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, I know. At the end of my road, you know, it's kind of like can't live with it and couldn't live without it. Mm-hmm. You know, that waking up every day, hating the fact that I have to live in this body, breathe air in this body, and suicide was always a factor. Mm-hmm. You know, the self-hatred was just tremendous. You know, mm-hmm. kind of living in the woods behind the labor pool, because my disease told me a while before that, you don't need to go to work today. So I really couldn't hold a regular job at that time, which I was a chef at the time, you know, so my profession at that time. So eventually my disease said you can't go to work anymore. So couldn't hold a job. So,
and one thing that I've learned about working in kitchens and staying sober is that those don't usually go together. And so was that something like when you did start getting sober, were you still wanting to be a chef, or were you like having to find a different way to make ends meet at that point?
No, I went back to it.
Okay.
Yeah, I had my sister, and this was before I got sober, right? My sister saw this ad where they would pay you to find you a job. And then when you start getting your checks, you pay them back. Mm. Food service, you know, and she told me about it, and she kind of, you know, it kind of wasn't my thing, but she ended up filling out the application, you know, for the service. And they called her back, because at first I didn't know anything about it, but talking to her, but I didn't know they had called her back, you know. So I got an interview, and it was strange. You know, scary, wasn't ready for it. You know, I mean, I was just a piece of shit, you know, just totally, you know, and the self-hatred that I had for myself and being out there for so long, being a crack addict and alcoholic, you know, there was no confidence in going to anybody's kitchen, you know, but I guess I pulled it off, you know. Yep. But that move, if it wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't have found recovery, I don't think, because of the strange way that I found recovery.
So what is that strange way that bamboozled you into recovery?
Well, I ended up getting a job at Bash Rip Rocks. It was a cooking position with a little bar over by Georgia Tech at that time.
What was the name of that place?
Bash Rip Rocks. And it was a college bar, you know, and I was in the kitchen. But I was at Five Points one day. So let me go back here, because I have to go back to tell this story. I was living over on Ashby Street, right? And I was living in this rooming house, and the whole house was infested, you know, with addicts.
Oh.
You know, everybody in the house. It was one of those kind of rooming houses, right? So this young lady lived there, and she was really like one of the last women on the face of earth that would sell me sex. You know, there were crack women going like, no, Ricky, I don't want your money. You just get the fuck out of my face, dude. You just need to. Yeah, that's how bad I was at that time, you know. But my friend, you know, and but like I say, it was the early 90s. And one day, I don't want to say her name, but my friend disappeared, right? And everybody was like, nothing in her room was gone. You know, she just disappeared. And coming out of the 80s, you know, it was just every time you turned around, some female was found dead on the side of the road behind a school or just that kind of stuff, you know? So we kind of thought was just, you know, because of the lifestyle we lived, you know? And but now that you know that story, now that you know that story, I'm so used to doing it. Now that I love her so much. Now that you know that story, so I was coming from that job down at Five Points, right? You know, still drinking, still smoking crack, just still an addict. So I think I'm going to perpetrate this fraud of going to this job, you know, because I think deep down inside it was like, okay, I'll do this, but I'm not going to last. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing, you know. But I was at Five Point Station, and I saw my friend. And it was like, it's like I had saw a ghost, you know. And it was like, where have you been? Everybody thought you was dead. Oh, my God, give me a hug. I thought you was dead. And just all of that stuff, right? And she was happy to see me. And she said, yeah, I got locked up, Ricky. And when I got locked up, I had to go to treatment. So that's what she had been. And you might find this strange, but that was the first person I kind of ever knew that had been in treatment, to be honest, you know. And she started telling me, yeah, after I got out of jail and all of that. And so at that point, my wonderful, wonderful friend started 12-stepping me and 13-stepping me at the same time. You know, honestly, you know, honestly. I always say my God has a sense of humor, you know, being who I was at that time, you know. Because, I mean, before I got clean, it was like every time I was with a woman, it wasn't no woman on the face of this earth that was like, oh, I just love being around Ricky. This guy is something fucking else. No, I didn't date. I didn't go to clubs. I didn't go to movies. I didn't go to bars. My disease robbed me of all of that. So every time I was with a woman, it was because of the game. Either I had the money or I had the dope or, you know, and that's where my manhood was at that time, because that was the only way I found myself. And it was just a ugly way to find your manhood, you know, because it was sick in itself, you know. But, you know, and you know, she said, Ricky, I've been going to these meetings. I'm going to take you to a meeting. I want to take you to a meeting. And, you know, at that time, it was like, I'll go to Timbuktu with you as long as it's some sex afterwards. You know what I mean? That's where my head was, because you wouldn't have never told me I would have found recovery. That's just not where I was. Mm-hmm. I wasn't part of that game. So she said, I'm going to come pick you up. I'm going to come pick you up and I'm going to take you to a meeting, you know. And she did, you know, and she took me. So I'm on my way to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting. You know, the Highland Club when it was over on Rogers Street. And I got 2 dime rocks of crack, 1/2 a pint of Mr. Boston, and 1/5 of Mad Dog on my way to my first Narcotics Anonymous meeting, you know, with my friend, you know. And so the getting clean part wasn't a part of it, you know. So I went to that meeting, didn't hear anything, because an addict sitting in a meeting where he don't want to go with 2 dime rocks, I wasn't in there probably about 10, 15 minutes, something like that, you know. So I had to leave, you know. And so I waited in the car, and, you know, there was sex with my friend afterwards, you know. So this is worthy. Rick, I'm going to come pick you up tomorrow and take you to a meet. Okay. You know, it's just kind of where I was, you know. And that's what lured me into recovery. And I think one of those meetings, what was strange, I ended up lasting to the end of the meeting. And the serenity prayer, when they got up and held hands and said the serenity prayer, I mean, that touched me, because it had been a long time since I had did anything like that. And it had been a long time since I had held hands in a freaking circle, you know, listening to people. And I thought to myself, God, they all know it. You know, because I didn't know it. I'm just standing there high, you know, doped out, you know. And it's like, this is really weird. But something about that, you know. And, you know, the sex kept luring me in. But it's kind of like my friend kind of just opened me up, right, and poured recovery down my throat. That's the only way I can explain it. And she didn't give up on me, you know. And at one point after the fact, she told me, she was like, my sponsor and all of these women in my network told me I need to leave you alone because I didn't want to get clean. You know, it was just a thing with me at that time, you know. Mm-hmm. So I was at another meeting and I heard somebody say, if you don't pick up a drink of liquor, you won't get drunk. If you don't pick up a hit of dope, you won't get high. And, you know, I didn't go through treatment, you know, and the conversation that me and had on the conversation,
we're going to have to bleep. We'll bleep
the conversation that me and my friend had after that, you know, after that meeting, that if you don't pick up thing resonated with me. You know, and so I went to work the next day and it was like, okay, where I worked at, the cooler there was where I went to get my cabbage and my vegetables and carrots or whatever. It was the beer cooler also, you know, beer, the kegs were in there, just all of that kind of stuff, right? So I'm standing outside this cooler and if I'm working in the kitchen, one part of my job, if I'm in your kitchen for 8 hours, is to steal and drink as much as I can in your kitchen. I mean, I'll drink Mad Dog in the street, but I drink all the cooking sherry and Chablis you got in your kitchen. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm a cook, you know. And so that was kind of my thing. I'd go in there and I'll gozle down a beer, come back out, get what I got. And that was kind of my daily routine, you know. And so I'm standing outside of this cooler, right? And it's like those people in the meeting say, Ricky, if you don't pick up a beer, you won't get drunk. Those people say, if you don't pick up a beer, you won't get drunk. Those people say, if you don't pick up a beer, you won't get drunk. And I'd run in there and I'd grab my carrots and I'd run back out. It's like, whew, I did it. I did it. So now I need some lettuce or something. So it's like I'm standing outside this big, huge monster, right? Because that's what I felt like this cooler was, you know. Those people in the meeting say, if you don't pick up a beer, Ricky, you won't get drunk. And I would run in, right? And I would come back out with my lettuce or whatever. And it was like, whew, I made it. And I think the joy of that, of trying, and where it came from, I don't know. But the joy of that in trying, it's what led me on the road, you know. And so after that, I got my shift drink and I got drunk, high, same routine. And I went and met my friend, right? And I was like, guess what I did today? I didn't steal anything at work today. I got my shift drink, yeah, but I didn't steal anything at work today. And I was like, and my friend said, oh, Ricky, I'm so proud of you. And that's all it took right there. I think when she said that to me, it moved something in me. She said, I'm so proud of you. So the next day, I did the same thing. And I couldn't wait to get back to say, guess what? I didn't steal anything at work today, you know. But I was, you know, cracked out by the time. And I'm on my way to another Narcotics Anonymous meeting because, it didn't happen yet, you know. But so I told her after one of those meetings, I'd say, tomorrow, I'm not going to steal anything and I'm not going to get my shift drink. You know, I might be drunk when you see me, but I'm not going to steal anything and I'm not going to get my shift drink, right? So I did that same thing. They say, what is addiction? It's repeating success. So when it worked for me at that time, it gave me what I need to keep doing. It gave me that joy. And to be honest, I wanted to be able to tell her something positive because she was proud of me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was huge. I can't sit here and tell you just how huge those words were coming from her, you know. So, but it got to the point, okay, I'm gonna go to work. I'm not gonna steal anything. I'm not gonna get my shift drink. And I'm gonna be clean and sober when I see you this evening. I remember telling her that as it was yesterday, you know. And I did it, you know, on that faith, you know, of what she was given to me and to make her proud of me. You know what I mean? And it was huge. And that was so her and some of the women in her network helped me detox. That's when my job found out that I was an alcoholic. They was like, Ricky, we would never do it. You know, really, you know. So I took off work and I detoxed with them, you know. And the first day clean and sober was April 15th, you know. And that's how it kind of started with me. But It was a rough road. I'm saying it in this little time frame we have, but you know, it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. You know, everything within me making that ride to her, you know what I'm saying? But you know what I had? You know what I had? What I really, really had? Those people in the meeting. Those people in that meeting say, if you don't pick it up, Ricky. Those people in that meeting, and with what my friend was giving me, gave me that hope. You know, it gave me that hope. And so I remember when I was about not even 30 days sober yet, right? And so this girl asked me, Ricky, you need to go in the cooler and tab a keg. And so I go in there and I'm getting ready to tap this keg. And guys, I go to tab it and beer splashed all over me, right? You know, all over my face. And it was like, oh my God, recovery kicked in. You know, I was like, oh, don't let it get to the mouth. My arm said, slap it. My elbow say, bend, don't let it get down the throat. And I'm like, almost like my arm came from West Mississippi somewhere, like, woo. Like it was the Matrix, right? It's like, don't let it get down the throat. You know what I mean? It's like, wah, 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 wah. And I'm slapping my face, you know? And I'm sitting in this cooler, y'all. And I'm in tears because it dawned on me that I wanted to be sober, you know? And I think everything changed. So I'm sitting in there on top of a keg, just in tears. It's like, I wanted to get in my throat. I did not want it to get in my throat. And I felt this joy. It's hard to explain, but I left out of that cooler a different person. You know, I left out a different person, you know. And but soon after that, it was like, Ricky, I'm going to have to stop having sex with you. Because that was a lure too. Don't get me wrong. She was like, Ricky, I'm going to have to stop having sex with you. You know, because, you know, I'm tired of my sponsor and stuff like that. And, you know, me and you ain't going to be girlfriend, boyfriend. So I need to stop having sex with you. You know, and so that happened. You know, and at this point, I'm coming to meetings. I've got a sponsor, you know, and so I'm getting ready to pick up my 30-day chip, right? So I pick up my 30-day chip, and my sponsor, who became my first sponsor, right? And the way I met him was, I had seen him in some of these meetings, right? So I'm sitting in a meeting, and it was a Friday, and the monkey was on me just tremendously, right? So I'm sitting in that meeting having this argument with myself. And this quiet, because you guys had, at that point, kind of listening to y'all turned me on to this boy that lived inside, because I heard y'all start talking about that kind of stuff, right? So that boy in me was like, Ricky, don't go pick up your check. You know what's going to happen if you go pick up your check, you know? And that man in me was like, fuck that shit. We going to pick up our check. Fuck that shit. What the hell you mean? Don't go pick up our check. I'm going to pick up my goddamn check, you know? But that boy in me was like, don't go pick up your check. Don't. And I think my clean time would have changed, right? So I'm sitting in that meeting so scared, right? And this gentleman, I had heard him share, and I went up to him and I said, hey, man, I'm scared to go get my check. Will you go with me to get my check? You know? And just like we do, he was like, yeah, Ricky, I'll go with you to get your check, you know, just like that, you know, and that's what we did, you know, and the next couple of Fridays, you know, he went with me to get my check, you know, and then it was like, okay, Ricky, not going with you to get your check anymore, but you can't cash it. You got to bring it to me. You know what I mean? And that was another one of those things, man, I'm taking in my check. I am not going to cash this check. I'm taking, I want him to be proud of me. I want him to be proud of me. You know what I mean? And so that's how I met my first sponsor, you know? And but he was the one, my 30 days, right? He said, Ricky, go get a plant. Go to Kroger or whatever. Whatever you do, gonna get any kind of plant but a cactus. You're not going to kill a fucking cactus. You know what I mean? So I ended up going to get a plant. He was like, take it home. Water it, love it, talk to it, take care of it. Don't kill the plant, Ricky. And at first, it was just kind of like, what? You know, I'm not a plant person at all, you know. So I went to buy this plant, and he would say to me, Ricky, he said, take it home, name it 30 days, and you take care of that plant. And he would say, Ricky, how's 30 days? Is it dead? You keeping it alive? 30 days still alive. 30 days still alive, man. I'm taking care of it. I'm talking to it. I'm loving it, you know. So, and to me, it was like the interaction that me and him had with that plant made me, because there were times in between 30 and 60 days, it was like, fuck this, I'm going to get high. It was on me, like those kind of things. And the thought would come to my mind, it's like, okay, I want to get 60 days. I want to get 60 days. I want to go get another plant, name it 60 days, take it home, introduce it to 30 days. 30 days, here's 60 days. Love both of them, you know? And it was once or twice during that time that that kept me sober, you know, because again, I wanted him to be proud of me. Mm-hmm. Because this plant thing was a huge thing to him. I just didn't know it yet. You know, so then 90 days, man, I went and got 90 days, took 90 days home, introduced 90 days to 30 days and 60 days. Now I'm loving on all of these plants, you know, so every time I picked up a chip, I got a plant, you know, and that stayed with me. Now I'm a plant lover. I've never been without plants since then, ever.
How many plants ever. Do you have
now? Now, since I moved, I got rid of some of the huge ones. I probably got about 7 now, and that's probably the I had one plant before I got rid of it, probably about 9 years. Yeah, so it was like I had one in my guest bedroom in my last house. My wife said, we are not taking this to the new house, right? But it was one of those running plants, and in the guest bedroom, the bed had the poles on it. Oh God, this thing was going all around the poles, all around the wall, everything. Wow. You know, so yeah. But it was kind of like during that time, I was on my way, you know, and he told me something that totally changed my life. And it's the reason that I'm here. You know, he said, Ricky, give your disease a name. So when it rears its head, you'll give it the respect it deserves. And I didn't think much of it. You know, it's like, yeah. Well, my middle name is Earl. We'll call it Earl, you know? And so going back to that, let me go back to this because then you'll understand kind of what big deal it was. Okay, so when my friend stopped having sex with me, right? Mm-hmm. Old behavior came out, you know? I still wanted to be clean, but I didn't want to mess with any recovery women at that time, you know? So, you know, this ideal and these bargains and these deals that I made with my hooker god, because I needed a hooker god. Other people maybe didn't need a hooker guy. I needed a hooker guy, you know, because I would leave meetings and go pick up women on the street because I wasn't driving at that time. I didn't have license, you know. I would go leave a meeting, walk the street, picking up women because even though I had money now, that's where my manhood was. That's where my addiction was. That's where who I was. It was still wrapped up into that. My friend just helped me mask it a little bit, you know, but when she wasn't there, there I go, you know, and I'm into that now and I can't stop. And I'm not telling anybody my secret. You know, I'm walking the street like I'm a crackhead hooker, like, you know what I mean? Picking up women, you know, and I'm making these deals with my hooker guy. Okay, we ain't going up in no trap houses. You know, she gonna slip my dick. She can do it in the bushes or whatever. We can do this. You know, I'm making these deals with God. She ain't gonna smoke nothing around me. She ain't gonna hit nothing around me. And I gotta go do this, God, because you know I'm a man and I need to. All of this kind of stuff, you know. But the basis of all of it was I didn't want to get high. That's why I'm making these deals, but I can't stop doing what I'm doing because that addiction is so powerful in my life. Even though I'm going to meetings, loving being clean and sober, you know what I mean? It was still that lifestyle that I wasn't ready, you know, standing over a woman and feeling like I had the power. There was a lot into that for me dealing with that side of the addiction. So I can't stop. I'm feeling like shit now, you know? And so I was with this girl one night and I'm like, you know, she was like, hurry up, hurry up. You ain't doing it right. Why don't you do it like this? You know what I'm saying? Then, you know, talking shit to me like, you know, well, give me my money. I ain't giving your motherfucking name back. Fuck you, you know, just dogging me out. And I'm clean and sober, spiritual as hell. Me and my hooker God is in here with her, right? But man, she turned on this old behavior in me. And next thing I know, she's up against the wall. I'm choking her. Goddamn bitch, you gonna give me my money back? And she's turning blue and I'm got her around the throat and just all of this kind of stuff. And it's like, Ricky, what are you doing? You know? And so I left from behind this house, you know, so I left and the next day I met my friend, you know, and I was like, I told him what I was doing. And he said, and this is the gentleman that became my first sponsor. He said, Ricky, if you got to do it, don't do it by yourself. You know, when I told him what I was doing. So it was kind of cool. You know, he had what I wanted. He had a car, you know, so we would go out and I would pick the one I want and he would get out of the car and I would have sex in his car now, you know, and my hooker God was with me. I would have sex in his car. I'd finish. We get back in and we go on about our business, you know. So that happened about three times, you know, but it wasn't fun anymore. You know, it wasn't fun anymore. So because I'm sharing about it, I'm telling him about it. It just didn't have the same appeal having him with me, you know. But him doing that gave me the courage to look at that addiction and say, I'm not fit for a woman. No woman, period. And it started me on over a year being celibate. You know, and that's what it took for me. You know what I mean? But going back to that, he was like, give that personality that lives in you a name, right? So I was like, okay, Earl, I call it Earl. So I'm on the train one day, right? And this girl get on the train and I don't know what it was about her, but she sparked something in me, you know? And there goes this voice. Go over there and say something to her, Ricky. You know, you got some money in your pocket. You ain't got your dick sucked in a while. Go on over there, Ricky. Go on, get your dick sucked. You know, go ahead. You ought to go ahead and do it. You ain't had it in a while. Everything will be all right. It'll be all right. You know, that voice, right? And I'm like, hell no. Shut the hell up. I know what's going to happen if I go over there and say something to her. I'm going to end up in the trap. I'm going to end up high. I'm going to end up drunk. And all of it's going to be over. No. Don't go say something. And it's like I had heard in meetings, if you don't know what to do, sit on your hands. Say the serenity prayer over and over. Play the tape all the way out. And I'm sitting on the train like a crazy freaking person. Like, no. This is going to happen. If I go over there, shut the fuck up. And all of a sudden I said, shut up, Earl. Shut up. While I'm sitting on my hands on the train like a crazy person. Shut up. And it dawned on me who Earl was in that moment. You know what I'm saying? So out of all of that, she gets off at Lindbergh Station And there it went. See there, you stupid motherfucker. You should have went on over there. Now she gone. Now you ain't gonna get your digs up. You ain't gonna get nothing, yada, yada, yada. And I'm on the train and this voice is all over me. It brought back these feelings that I could not handle at that time, you know? And I'm ready to go use. The only reason I'm not using at that moment, I'm on the freaking train, right? So I get off at Five Points and I'm ready to use, you know? And so I get off at Five Points and during that time, right? It was kind of like the gentleman that became my first sponsor told me, he said, men that don't practice networking with other men, don't network with other men. So we had went on this journey, right? Every meeting you go to, get a new phone number, make a new friend, that kind of thing. Real big in those days, right? So I would go to meetings and, you know, it was like, Ricky, just walk up to the guy, you know, shake his hand. It ain't like you got to sleep with him. You know what I mean? So I would walk up to a guy and was like, put my hand out. Hey, man, I like what you said. Can I get your number? You know, so that was my line. It's like I was picking them up. You know what I'm saying? That was my line, man. And I started getting these numbers. And it's like he said, Ricky, make a time in your night. Read one paragraph out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what you start the conversation off with. And I start calling these men, you know, because at that time, it's like nobody had cell phones. You know, only people had cell phones, people like Tupac and Biggie, you know. People like me didn't have a cell phone, so it was all payphone, you know, and, you know, you had to work in those days, man. It's like even, you know, you would call your sponsor and you would leave a message on his voicemail, you know, not voicemail, answer machine. Then when he get home, he would beep you and then you would call him back, you know, find a payphone or whatever, right? So I was in that habit. So when I got to Five Points, man, that payphone right there by the men's bathroom, man, I got on that phone and it was like, man, I called the first guy. Man, I was on the train and this girl got on the train and then I was on her, and then I wanted to go get high and then she wanted to have sex with me and then yada, 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 right? And I'm talking to his answering service. He didn't pick up, right? So because repeating success with addiction, you know, just like when Bill was at the Mayflower, when I got off from his answering machine, I called another guy. Man, I was on the train and this girl was over here and I feel like I'm finna go use. And taking that action is what did it, you know, because the next guy I called picked up, you know, and I told him what had happened and we talked, you know, and now I'm able to go on my way, right? And so when I got back to my sponsor, I told him what had happened. And he said something to me. He said, Ricky, it'll never get any harder than it got today. If you never believe the lie that this time it will be different, you'll never take another drink one day at a time. And for myself, I can prove that to be true. I can say that's true for me. I ain't saying that's true for anybody else, but that's true for me. You know what I'm saying? I've yet to believe that lie. And the beauty of that is, I'm an alcoholic who's convinced that I'm an alcoholic, first off, that I have a disease, that what happens in my body, when I pour liquor down my throat, it sets off a physical craving and I cannot stop drinking liquor. I've proved that to myself. When I start coming to meetings and I start listening to you guys tell me your experience and I identify, I knew I was the kind of alcoholic that they are talking about. You know what I'm saying? So I'm convinced that anything other than once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic is a lie, period. You know, it's a lie. And he said, Ricky, the only reason you can take a drink after you detox is out of habit. You know, and that's what Bill talks about. He talks about like chapter three. Chapter three is all about what's on the alcoholic's mind before he take the drink. And he know he has a problem, but what's on his mind? Because nobody relapse drunk. You know, you're dead sober when you relapse. So my alcoholic thinking at some point have to be more powerful than my sober thinking. You know, that's the only way, you know, because I can only crave liquor if I pour it down my throat. You know, we hear people say, oh, I was craving, not knocking about what anybody's saying. But if I don't pour liquor down my throat, I'll never crave alcohol. You know, the obsession. Bill always talks about what's going on in the mind of the alcoholic. Like what you were saying earlier, you know, the road to relapse. We start relapsing before, you know, but that voice in my head that I call Earl that lives between my ears will say, oh, well, you don't need to go to a meeting. Because I remember when I first got clean, it was like, get up and leave. Don't hold anybody's hands and say the Lord's Prayer. Why do I need to call a man? I ain't calling a man. Why do I need to call a man? I ain't got nothing to talk to a man about. You know, just all of that ignorant stuff that I brought in the rooms with me, you know. And but, you know, if I don't think I can go out and drink, I won't drink. You know what I'm saying? I have to. And some people say, well, you can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. But, you know, I didn't magically do anything when I got here. But what happened was you guys gave me new information. If you don't pick up a drink, you won't get drunk. This thing about Earl. And the cool thing about Earl is in my recovery, you know, I'm sober today, one white chip for 35 years because of one reason. I mean, I got the steps and I got a God in my understanding, and she is as pretty as a picture. Let me tell you, I got a God in my understanding. I got the steps. I got the spiritual aspect of it. I got all of that stuff going on that make me not cheat on my wife or steal my neighbor's lawnmower under his deck, you know. But I'm sober today because I've yet to believe the lie that if I pour liquor down my throat, it won't set off a physical craving. Mm-hmm. And for 35 years, Earl have tried to convince me of that. Earl don't go away. Some people say, well, he's out in the parking lot doing push-ups. No, he's sitting in a meeting with me. Earl is everywhere I go. It's my thinking. It's that thing that lives between my ears. But this is what's cool about it, you know. Earl don't have hands. And Earl don't have legs. And Earl don't have arms or elbows. So Earl, no matter what he says between my ears, cannot go get his own self a hit of crack. He cannot go get his own self a beer. You know what I mean? He's got to convince me, the clean and sober me. I woke up this morning loving who I am, me, to go get him a drink of liquor. You know? And so I owned a cleaning service for years, right? And this analogy of Earl that I love, and I hope it helps someone out, you know, this analogy, and I'm like 17, I owned a cleaning service for like 26 years, right? Janitorial service. So I'm in this building, right? Cleaning it, me, God, and Earl, you know? So these people had maybe a party or something afterwards. So I'm cleaning up the break room, right? So there's beer bottles all on the table, beer in the trash. So I go over, you know, putting some stuff in the trash, and poof, I get this loud smell of beer in my nose. You know what I'm saying? And there went Earl. Ooh, what was that, Ricky? It's been a long time since you smelled beer like that. Oh, wow. Look at that beer. Smells good, don't it? And I'm regular cleaning, and Earl just would not shut up. Oh, man, you ain't had no smell like that. And clean your nose out or something, Ricky. Go there to paper towel. This is all this shit Earl is saying. You know what I'm saying? And I'm like, God, you hear him, right? You hear him, right? I'm sick of him. So I put all the beer bottles, right? Because sometimes for me, Earl comes out of my head and he has to be a person standing in front of me that I can say, fuck you. You know? And that kind of thinking, that kind of action gets me out of the thinking that I'm thinking. So I put all the beer bottles in the trash can, right? Roll my barrel outside to the back door. Get the bag with all the beer stuff in it. Take it outside. Throw it in the dumpster. Come back in. Lock the door, right? And I'm like, Earl, out of all the liquor stores I pass by every day, you're trying to convince me to drink a beer out of the trash in this building. Shut the and leave me alone. Me and God finna go back to work. And I'm like, God, can you believe what this son of a bitch was trying to do? Can you believe what he was trying to do? And I'm like, if you want to drink, Earl, some beer out of the trash, take your ass on out there. And I'm still sober because you know why? You know why? Because Earl don't have legs and he don't have hands and he couldn't go unlock the back door and go get the beer out of the trash and drink it himself. You know?
I'm just thinking, like, out of context, somebody's like, what did Earl fucking do? Earl got no legs. This poor man named Earl.
But, you know, and that's it, you know? And so I worked the steps by way of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I worked the steps with the columns, you know, and the people I sponsored, that's how they worked the steps, you know. And I think the coolest thing about, you know, a lot of people talk about the fourth step, you know, I'm resentful at the cause. But then that next column is what instinct was harmed. And, you know, people don't talk about the instincts enough. You know, all emotional problems stem security, social, or sex instinct, which is all given to us by God and surely good. Even we all animals have them, you know, but the program tells me it's when these instincts are out of whack, it's when I get all crazy, you know? And at that time, my sponsor was like, Ricky, live your life in the instincts, you know? And I would get on the bus and speak to the bus driver and he didn't speak to me or something like that. It's like, What instinct was harmed? All right, kind of my social instinct because I needed that connection right there. You know, is it fear? Well, was it my sex instinct? No. Kind of, you know, my security instinct, was it? Yeah, kind of. He kind of made me feel bad. And I started living my life identifying with these instincts. You know what I'm saying? Trying to get them in tune. And it was just amazing. You know, the effect that that had on me in doing the fourth step, you know, and it went on to, you know, resentful at, you know, where did I set the ball in motion, column five, you know, what was the exact nature of my wrongs, you know, and so those were the things that I worked on that were objectionable. It's kind of like a resentment I had at my mother, you know, that came out in my fourth step. In my sex sheet that came out, it's like the resentment at my mother was the reason I never, ever had a successful relationship with any other woman. The hatred, you know, that I lived through, that I came up with, that thing, people say it ain't real, but it's real. You know, it came out in my fourth step, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And it's kind of like, okay, my mom did the best she did. You know, it's kind of like when I was 9 years old, they should have just took me out in the backyard and blew my freaking brains out. You know, the world would have been a lot better because I was a terrible son. You know, I was a terrible son. And but during that time, my introduction to addiction, right? So my father came home when I was 13. It started when I was 13 and he had cancer. So he kind of came home in a hospice situation, right? So, and I think that damaged me at that time, having to bathe my dad, having to take care of my dad, having to watch him dwindle away, being able to just pick him up in my arms and take him to the bathtub and that kind of stuff, you know? So, and my relatives were so ignorant. I had nobody to talk to about the experiences that were going on in my household. You know, and my mom, a lot of that anger, well, look at you now, yada, yada, you know, just all of that kind of stuff. And it was terrible, you know, and I start taking these high-powered cancer medicine that my dad had, you know, so now I'm passing out at school, you know, that kind of thing. And that's where that addiction started to narcotics, you know. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where we are in the hour. I'm just running my mouth.
No, this has been great. We are approaching the end of the hour.
Okay.
But what I appreciate so much about your story is its unconventional start into recovery, right? Because that's the stuff, like a lot of the things you touched on there were like taboo things that just don't really get talked about. You know, because it's like not necessarily, you know, like a bright and shining moment for mm-hmm. some people, but it's like what I heard in that was people meeting you where you were, and then people meeting your friend where she was too, where it's like that was working for both of y'all until it wasn't, you know. And I mean, the way I kind of crowdsourced my way into sobriety was something really similar, because I had reconnected with an ex and his sponsor was like, absolutely not, don't talk to that girl, like if she's still gonna be getting fucked up, absolutely not. And because he was one, like, he just kept like relapsing. That was, and like even when he and I were together years prior, like that's what was true. It's like he just couldn't string any time together. And so like I felt like I took that as a personal attack, like when his sponsor said that to him, not me. Mm-hmm. And so I got sober out of spite, because I'm like, I'm a good person, you know. But what it was I needed that validation from somebody, because mm-hmm. I just was too uncomfortable being alone. I just, you know, that version of myself, I couldn't be alone with her. Mm-hmm. And so it got me into the rooms, and it got me, I mean, that relationship didn't work out obviously, but you know, it got me into sobriety. And you know, was it unconventional? Yeah. Was it healthy? No. Did it work? Yeah. You know, like task failed successfully. But that then your friend loved you enough and herself enough to listen to her sponsor and the women in her network and leave you be. Like, we can't do this anymore. And then I absolutely loved the thing about the plants. I never heard something like that before. And so I'm just picturing, because the places you're talking about, you know, with Lindbergh, Low Five, I'm not imagining like greenhouses. You know, like I'm imagining some dusty shelf. Yeah. But here's these plants, you know, just like growing, and it's working. You're talking to them and it's working, and now it's like become part of your life today. Like the super unconventional, like you're not into plants, and this guy is like, just do this thing, and you're so desperate to have this new type of life that you'll just do it. And you listened, and you mm-hmm. and it worked. You know, like picking up a new plant every time you picked up a chip. That is beautiful. I think that's amazing. I'm really sad that you didn't get to keep the plant that was circling around the bedpost and on the walls. That sounded magical.
I got a video of it out there somewhere, I'm telling you.
Oh, man, you'll have to share that with us. But, I mean, there's, you know, a lot of turns in your story, because a lot of it is, it's just, I mean, with anybody, it's all connected. You know, you can't look at this without looking at that. And I think too, a very relatable aspect is just sitting with yourself in early sobriety. I would not sit with myself for 3 years. Like my first 3 years sober, I constantly was with somebody, because I just could not be alone with that mm-hmm. version of myself. And when I finally took that time away where it was like, no, it's just me. Again, like, it's just me. That's it. It's just me. Was the best year of my life, where I finally got to, it was uncomfortable for the beginning and a little bit throughout it. And it hurt and I cried and it was painful and raw. But like what I gained from that, I wish I took what people suggested and did that my first year. Because where could I have been, you know, so much further? I waited 3 years. And, like, that's one thing that I would do over. But that portion, it's like, it just sounds like, you know, oh, that's just talk. People just say that, oh, I have needs. It's like, yeah, those are needs, but you also have emotional needs, and you need to learn what they are first. And in my experience, I could only learn them when I was alone with myself. So yeah, I loved all of like the different roads you went down, sharing your story with us tonight. That was, you know, very transparent and open. And thank you for doing that.
Yeah, thank you.
Josie, do you have any thoughts, comments, questions, concerns? I saw your face.
No, it was great. It was, I appreciate your vulnerability and your honesty. You know, I kept thinking it was like, a couple of things I thought about. One of them was the search for recovery in the coochie. That could be the name of your memoir. And where are you? Are you still in contact with that friend today?
No. She went, as a matter of fact, she went home to get custody of her son.
Oh, good.
And went to Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah. But awesome. I did lose touch over the years.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious.
When she left Atlanta, she was still clean and sober.
Okay, good. Yeah, good. Yeah. And the other thing was, you know, you don't really, earlier today, we talked about like sex and, you know, learning yourself and figuring out who you are in recovery. And it's funny that you're here now because I feel like people just don't talk about that enough, you know, like that type of vulnerability and honesty. So it's a breath of fresh air, you know? For me, I was always in relationships during active alcoholism, and probably being on my own has been like the best thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the search for recovery and the coochie continues.
For you?
And that's all I've got for everyone.
Oh, my God.
Well, also, if I may say, you know, that year that I said after that happened and I was celibate, oh, my God, so much happened in that year, you know, because it was the first time I had ever had female friends. Mm. You know, it opened up all of that. You know? And then there were women that I could flirt with or satisfy the emotional part of it. I started getting female friends. This girl told me one time, me of all people, that, Ricky, I feel like I can talk to you about anything.
Yeah.
You know, and there was a point during that time where it was like, it was this one girl that I really liked. Because, y'all, I had got my own apartment at that time, my first apartment. You know, I went to the Fleet Market, bought my own bed. It wasn't the Army's bed. It wasn't my mama's bed. It wasn't a woman's bed. It was my bed. First time I'd ever bought a bed. And I had red satin sheets. Red satin pillow, something I always wanted, and now I got it, you know. But it got to a point with this one girl, it was like, I don't want to mess this up. No, I can't. I don't want to mess this up, you know, because I still wanted to be celibate. You know, it's like, I don't want to mess this up. I like where our friendship is, you know. And mm-hmm. It was kind of like, okay, you know, two or three times, you know, after talking to you, I go home and masturbate. That was the first conversation I had with her that broke the ice. You know what I mean? So now it's out in the open. You know, I'm having those kind of feelings about you, but I don't want to have those kind of feelings about you. Now we're talking about it, right? Now we're friends now. I don't have to perpetrate a fraud. I don't have to say, oh, well, take this and go and get you a Mata card. Just give it back to me. Because in the back of my mind, it's like, yeah, I'm going to get this one day. I'm just setting up. All of that was wiped out. Mm-hmm. Now I can be a friend. You know what I mean? So a lot of that I learned during that time, you know, that I didn't need a woman to be all right. But yeah, we're at the end of that. Girl, I can just, whew, let me tell you.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing, the other thing that,
sorry, you had me at the, when I talked to you, I go masturbate three times. I'm like, gee willikers. What kind of conversations are we having? So freaking, you're
just
literally stimulating.
Just her speaking to me saying hello. You know, just us catching the train together after the meeting and having a friendship. Because I didn't know how to handle that.
Mental masturbation.
Yes. Yeah. No, I'm talking about physical.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Also, yeah. I mean, because, you know.
He's like, no, like, I really did.
It was like, okay, I'd rather do this than make her feel like I want to have sex with her.
Right.
You know what I'm
saying? Right.
But then it was a kind of phony aspect of that also. But then when I was able to tell her my feelings, it was kind of like, we ain't got to worry about that. Now we can be friends. You know what I'm saying? Because, mm-hmm. Okay, Ricky, you feel like that. Now we will make sure that never happens. Let's make sure that never happens.
Yeah.
Now I got her on my side and I'm on her side.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was beautiful. And that was like the first girlfriend that I ever had in my life. Uh-huh. You know, kind of with my friend also, but she was different. You know, she was like somebody that I was really, really attractive to. And now we're friends. Like, you know, that kind of
friends.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes. But also, I got to experience in her life, because we stayed friends for years, her boyfriends, you know, and her getting my advice and her being able to be open with me and us, you know, just all of that good stuff that comes with the friendship, you know. Yeah, it was pretty cool. I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah. No, because the road to friendship is difficult. I was talking to someone, another woman recently, and she was like, I don't understand why it's so difficult to be friends with people, especially in the rooms, especially the opposite gender. And I was like, you just kind of like start to pick up on like certain cues, certain cues of like, I don't want just to be friends, or like the intention is not just to be friends. Like there's just like certain things that you pick up on. And it's like it's a beautiful process because yeah, you just get to learn, you know, the qualities that you're looking for in friendship. Beautiful.
Well put. Well put.
Thank you.
Well, as we come in for a close, is there anything that you would want to leave the listeners with?
Thank you, Christian, for all that you do. Thank you to Most High Media for all the support that, oh my God, that they have given UE Entertainment Recovery News over the years. I mean, watching Most High grow has been such a blessing. They have supported, Most High Media have supported me in all of my events, you know? So we have been such a connector. You know, Christian would always tell me that Ricky is the connector, you know, and but I've just loved their support, and I'm just honored to be here again, you know. And I've wanted to for so long, but then I've been torn and, you know, just couldn't do it. So, you know, when I was talking to Jason and we figured out a date, it's like, okay, if some come up, put me in pencil. But guys, I have been super excited about having the opportunity to be right here again, especially with you two ladies. Just great job. Great job.
I'm happy you're here, and I'm happy you're alive.
Yes, definitely.
All right. Well, we'll just go ahead and wrap this up. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you, if they want to learn about entertainment, if they just are like, hey, Ricky, I want to say hi?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Ricky Davis. You can find me there. And UE Entertainment Recovery News is a Facebook group.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. In the description box, well, this is going to be an audio episode, so just check out the Most High Media app. You can download it in the Google Store, the Apple Store, and Roku City, baby. And there you can find all the episodes of the podcast, as well as documentaries and shows. Make sure to share this. And we're on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Most High Media. So make sure to follow us. And yeah, thank you to our donors, our sponsors. And this has been the Most High Show. Good night, everyone.
Boo, boo.